it becomes our priority to make sure that we have people on the ground that are able to offer ongoing support in order to ensure that the well-being and the basic needs of women and girls that have gone through harrowing, harrowing experiences are being met.
Welcome to The Lid Is On, a podcast series from UN News in New York. I'm Matt Wells. What's it been like trying to meet the needs of hundreds of thousands of desperate civilians who fled for their lives across the Bangladesh border, often with nothing more than the clothes on their back? In this edition, we're going to take you to the strangely named epicenter of the world's worst refugee emergency, Cox's Bazaar, where hundreds of UN specialists have been working for weeks now to help families who've suffered appalling abuses, which the UN Human Rights Chief characterised in September as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. In particular, we'll be hearing how vital services are for women and girls who've been subjected to brutal gender-based violence, or GBV.
Hello and welcome. I'm Veronica Pedroza, communications consultant for the UN Population Fund, or UNFPA, and you're joining me at the hub of United Nations decision-making for the Rohingya refugee crisis at the World Food Programme offices in Cox's Bazaar, Bangladesh. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by two people deeply involved in the relief effort. But first, some background. 2 months since this emergency began on the 25th of August, there are now some 600,000 people who've arrived exhausted, desperate, and destitute from Myanmar. The reports of the violence that drove them here have often been horrifying and almost incomprehensible in their brutality. But what led to this situation? Here's Francis Wade, author of the recently published book, Myanmar's Enemy Within.
Well, the cause appears to have been an attack by Rohingya militants on August 25th on a series of police outposts, and these were coordinated attacks. They targeted, I think, 30 different stations, barracks, and that provided a pretext, I suppose, for the military to sweep in to northern Rakhine State, go from village to village, razing villages, executing civilians, and forcing 600,000 plus Rohingya into Bangladesh. But there now appears to be evidence that the Myanmar military had deployed forces to Rakhine State prior to the August 25th attacks. And if we look at the sort of years of persecution of Rohingya, going back not just to the first wave of violence in 2012, but, you know, back to the sort of late 1990s, when severe control measures were placed on Rohingya movements, access to healthcare, access to education, there appears to have been a long-term effort to weaken the security of the group and perhaps undermine their ability or weaken their ability to actually exist in the state. So one might look at the current wave of violence as the next step in pushing the Rohingya out of the country into Bangladesh.
Can you go into more detail about the restrictions that Rohingya were facing immediately before those attacks that you mentioned on August the 25th? Because there were thousands in camps and they remained there.
That's right. So I think we need to go back to 2012, which was the first major eruption of violence between Rakhine Buddhists and Rohingya Muslims, at least in the last half century or so. Then we had, in late May that year, the rape of a Rakhine woman by three Rohingya men. And that prompted attacks between Rohingya and Rakhine. Several hundred people were killed, but the larger effect, I suppose, was to prompt acute segregation of the two communities. So 140,000 odd Rohingya fled into internment camps where they were confined and where they still remain. And those are mainly around the state capital of Sitwe. You also had further north in the state, Rohingya confined to villages. There were limits on how far they could move outside of their villages. And also Rohingya in the state capital, Sitwe, in the town itself, who were confined to what essentially became barricaded ghettos that were manned by armed guards. So it took on the appearance of an apartheid system. Rohingya in the north of the state, where the current violence is happening, had already for 20 years or so before that, or 30 years even, been subjected to quite severe restrictions on their movement. And so, for example, if they wanted to go from one township to another, they would have to apply for a certificate, a permit that would allow them to go, that would state how long they'll be spending in the town, where they would be staying, and if they were to stay beyond the time frame given in the permit, then they would suffer a form of punishment, financial or imprisonment. And so it was obvious that there was this very sort of severe apparatus of control existing well before the current violence we're seeing. And with each iteration of the violence that's happened since 2012, those control measures have been tightened even more.
Can you put this in the context of the way that Myanmar has changed, and also in the context of what the mostly Buddhist public's perception of Muslims is?
Well, the transition, I suppose, officially began in March 2011, and that's when the former ruling party, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, which is aligned to the military, took power. And then so that was the end of, I suppose, overt military rule of the country. Then a year later, in April 2012, the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, took, 43 seats in by-elections. So they entered parliament for the first time. And so it appeared that after 2011, you know, Myanmar was gradually moving towards civilian rule. But what also happened around that time was the eruption of violence between Rakhine Buddhists and Rohingya Muslims in the west of the country. That was June 2012. We also had a rekindling of long dormant ethnic conflicts elsewhere in the country, for example, in the north, in Kachin State. So there was this sort of paradox of an advancing democratization process and worsening violence against ethnic minorities. With regards to the sort of Buddhist-Muslim tensions in the country after the 2012 violence, which was largely confined to Rakhine State, we then had these sort of simmering, budding Burmese Buddhist nationalist movements, often led by monks, which sermonized, referencing what was happening in Rakhine State, sermonized on the threat that Islam posed to Buddhism in the country, that it was a colonizing, crusading force bent on overwhelming Buddhism and dislodging it from its central place in Burmese society. What began as a conflict largely confined to Rakhine State soon spread to towns in the center of Myanmar, where there had been a long history of warm interfaith relations between Buddhists and Muslims. So it's as if the conflict almost went nationwide, and there were monks and Buddhist nationalist groups stoking the flames of resentment. There were political leaders who were jostling for positions of power in a change in Myanmar, who were manipulating the religious divide, throwing up this idea that Islam was a threat to Burmese Buddhist society, and in doing so helping to rally people to their political cause.
Author Francis Wade there. Given the situation he's described, it's likely the refugee crisis on this side of the border will be prolonged. It wasn't easy to find time to take a few minutes out of their busy schedules, but a bit earlier I managed to sit down a couple of people who are deeply involved in the monumental task of providing for a people that have been described as the world's most persecuted. I'm joined by two very special people, two of my favourite people, in fact, in Cox's Bazaar. They're experts in what they do, and they are really passionate about their work. On my left, for the World Food Programme.
Hi, my name's Karim Elgendi. I've been the head of Cox's Bazaar sub-office for a year and a half. Now I'm acting as the field operations head.
And in front of me?
My name is Saba Zarif. I'm the gender-based violence subsector coordinator, and I've been here for about 9 months now.
And she's my colleague at the United Nations Population Fund.
Indeed.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you two here is because you were here from the very beginning. So let me ask you what it was like at the beginning. I mean, you are normally based in Dhaka, right?
Yes.
Saba, so you came in on what, day one or two?
Yeah, I actually arrived 1 or 2 days preceding the influx.
Oh, I see.
And if you can imagine, at the time, I probably wasn't, at least personally, estimating over maybe 5 to 10,000. And I landed in Cox's probably around August 24th and have not left since.
Wow.
And the numbers have been growing and growing and growing in ways that we could have never anticipated, in fact.
Yeah. Kareem, you were head of sub-office, as you mentioned, so did you get a tip?
Yeah, we were on the ground. We were actually, I wouldn't say it was a full-on emergency, but we were still attending the over 80,000 refugees who came last year.
Yeah.
Fingerprinting,
absolutely.
Biometrics, and this. So it felt, for us, a much smaller office at the time, like it was already an emergency. There was anticipation and hints. However, yes, like Saba said, we never imagined until we went to the camp that day and we found thousands of people everywhere, and that's where it all began.
Journalists have told me that it was utter chaos that first week. There were people in the street like 5 deep, and there was a fighting over whatever aid was available. How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, I remember on day one of the influx, there was just people everywhere throughout Kudupalong Register Camp. It was everything different from what we had hypothesized or expected. We expected people maybe would go to Teknaf, which is what usually happened in the past.
Because so that's nearer the border, that's south
yeah.
part.
Yeah, so we were a bit thrown off, and I just happened to be there. I called my counterpart in the government, and we agreed we should just start distributing immediately, no hesitation. After that, more and more and more people came gradually over the 2 weeks. And then, yeah, it did look like that. There was people everywhere. There was ad hoc shelters everywhere. It was basically, you'd have to say it was madness.
Saba, your expertise is in gender-based violence. What was it like for you when the influx started and then the people just kept on coming?
The first priority, as more and more people were beginning to come across the border, was to make sure that we were mobilizing all of the human resources we had on the ground, all of the programmatic capacity at our disposal, in order to act. As UNFPA, we had 5 facilities where we were offering core programming for women and girls. The aim was really to ensure that those facilities were still open and available, and that our volunteers, our community mobilizers, and our caseworkers were on the ground trying to disseminate key messages about where to find and access the services that were available.
Yeah, I want to ask the two of you if you can provide any kind of anecdote that would help listeners understand the scale of this.
I mean, compared to now, it was like a trickle. It was tens of thousands. We'd already had practice from last year, going from 0 to 80,000 in general food distribution. But then it just grew, and we found that persons were not able to cook. It had gone beyond the capacity of their friends and family who were already here to host them. It looked like it was going to go out of control, but we've all scaled up significantly. We've had surge teams come in. We've had donors come in. So, I mean, eventually, it looks like it's under control, but it was something much more than anyone had expected.
Yeah, for me, it's seeing those camps really crowded and just so many people in each tent and some people in the open air still.
The most striking image the first few days and weeks of the response were the numbers of women and children. Virtually every woman holding a child, oftentimes the child being under the age of 5. The first few weeks in particular, people were finding any open space available to settle. There were, along the main roads, there were informal shelters being built up. And within weeks, those informal shelters were being taken down.
And for the layman, what does informal shelter mean? couple of sticks of bamboo and tarpaulin, yeah?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
How much has changed since then?
We have a lot more infrastructure in place. There's a lot more intentionality about making sure that where people are choosing to set up shelter, that we're also trying to buffer that with some of the basics they need for survival. Where they're putting together bamboo and tarpaulin huts for themselves, we're also trying to complement by putting in latrines and making sure that we're establishing spaces where we can have programming for adolescent girls, or having safe environments where women and girls can come together and ask questions and gain clarity about where they can go for some of the services that they need.
Yeah, those woman-friendly spaces have turned out to be really important, I think. They were telling me at one just yesterday that they saw 4,000 people in one day at the beginning of the influx, and that was just in Shamlapur. What about you, Karen?
I remember doing an earlier interview and saying everybody is so scattered, it's difficult to get food to them. And one thing that's happening now is that they're all populating one area. They're being ushered towards the mega camp, supposedly. It's so difficult to access the people that are in the middle of that 8x8 kilometer area, which is also starting to absorb the camps around it. So scattered or not, it's still an immense task. And even though we feel like things are a bit more systematic, yeah, we have like a general food distribution schedule. We do it every 2 weeks. Even though it's more systematic, it's so fragile. We're having emergencies within emergencies. So we're distributing rice, lentil, and oil, and coordinating partners to do that. But at the same time, I mean, for example, we had like almost 10,000 people walk in a large group across the border at Anjamampara, and they couldn't cook. They didn't know where they were. They didn't know where their friends and family were. So we have to distribute a different kind of food. And then we see that there's a lot of pregnant and breastfeeding women with small children, and they need another kind of food. So there are still emergencies within the overall emergency going on.
One thing that's got a lot of media attention, Saba, is gender-based violence, including rape. What's it like when you hear them?
I guess the principal focus for us is to ensure that when women and girls and other vulnerable groups are received in Bangladesh, that the systems and the services are in place for them to receive life-saving care. For a survivor of gender-based violence, particularly for a survivor of sexual violence, it's important that emergency medical care is provided in order to prevent unwanted pregnancy, in order to prevent sexually transmitted infection, in order to prevent HIV or AIDS. And so it becomes our priority to ensure that information is being spread throughout the communities about where these services are available, and also to make sure that we have people on the ground that are able to offer ongoing support in order to ensure that the well-being and the basic needs of women and girls that have gone through harrowing, harrowing experiences are being met.
Karim, the World Food Programme has made a point of recognizing how effective it is to have women receive aid. Can you explain that?
There's no doubt about that. I mean, especially when there's so many single female-headed households.
One in five.
Yeah, it's obvious. And aside from that, we prefer the woman to manage the food needs of the household. We also have extensive gender empowerment or women empowerment programs. So it's really embedded in our programs. Aside from that, cross-cutting issues like protection, GBV, disabilities are mandatory, yes.
Let's take a break for a moment in the discussion, because I want to point out that the head of OCHA came here recently, Mark Locock, and met some women survivors of gender-based violence, and he commented afterwards.
I sat for an hour or so with 24 women who had fled just in the last few days and weeks from Myanmar, and they told us their stories. I think the important thing is that these women who've suffered so greatly now get the help that they need, the counselling, the food, the shelter, the protection, the medical and other related services. It's really important that, as we have done, we incorporate the gender-based violence element into that, the programming for UNFPA, for UN Women, for other relevant organisations. That's an essential part of the overall response. So I have a 17-year-old daughter and I'm married, and I hear the stories of those women and those young girls, and I can't contemplate how terrible it would be to imagine my own wife or daughter being in those kind of circumstances. It's beyond human, the kinds of suffering that those women have been put through.
It sounds kind of simple, but it is a kind of breakthrough that there's this recognition that GBV and special needs of women are an essential part of the humanitarian response in this emergency. What struck you about it? Is it a new approach that's come to attention here because of all the horrific stories that could become a model going forward?
This is the way it's supposed to be, and it should be, and it should be institutionalized. But, I mean, let's take the positive out of the negative. Now we've got the world's attention. We have media coming in. We have a lot of other colleagues around the world paying attention to what's going on here. Let's take advantage of this. And not just institutionalize this, but understand why it has to be this way.
This is by no means a new model. It's also not a revelation. We know as a humanitarian community that gender-based violence is often the byproduct of displacement and is often used as a weapon in armed conflicts to try and disrupt communities. These words only underscore how important it is that we really prioritize the availability of specific services for survivors of gender-based violence.
Is there a story, something that's happened to you that you personally experienced that's made you kind of realize the scale of what needs to be done?
I mean, I've been in a lot of influxes around the world, and they're all slightly different. You always try to compare it to something you've been in before. But this was different. I mean, I remember in Anjamanpara, we could see up to 1,000 people just walking down the road towards Kudupalong. The police cut off the traffic, and it was incredible. You know, there was elderly, there was disabled people. We use our own money to pay for some tom-toms just to take them
back.
Tom-tom,
I think you need to explain.
Tom-tom
that.
Might be a tuk-tuk in some countries, or a rickshaw.
Yeah.
And you know, we just became humans that day. You know, yeah. We do a lot of emails, a lot of meetings, we have a lot of protocols, but on the ground, you know, it was just do whatever you can for everybody. When you see someone who looks unwell, it's natural instinct to do that, you know, as humanitarian workers, we might become desensitized doing this for years and years. So it's nice to know that we can still feel that way. Veronica, one thing that's getting to me is that you can never let your guard down. There's always something. So once we stabilize whatever it was at the time, 500,000, which now sounds incredible. You let your guard down, then suddenly you have 10,000 people crossing at the same time.
Right.
You let your guard down, you're coming back from a field mission. There's two vehicles collided and Rohingyas are bleeding all over, whole family. You let your guard down, there's elephants stomping on people. This has happened twice.
It has.
And that's no joke.
I know. It's supreme irony, isn't it?
There's things happening all the time, apart from what you expect. Sickness, is reported that a lot of babies are dying. And what do you expect? They're living in squalid conditions. They're not used to this. They had a little piece of land, something to call home. They had their livestock. They weren't born into this, you know, but the next generation might be, right? We've had refugees here for 25 years. We had more come 10 years ago. We had 80,000 come last year, and now?
I mean, I feel the same way as you. It's like whatever you do still feels like it's not enough because something always comes up.
I think for us, the major point, too, is that we can't just say they without acknowledging that there are mothers, sisters, daughters that have very, very unique needs and oftentimes get forgotten in the planning process and are susceptible to incredible risks just in the process of flight, and then are challenged
to be fully represented and fully accounted for in the way that we try to ensure that humanitarian aid is equally and equitably divided across all that have been impacted.
You know, everyone asks about numbers when it comes to GBV victims, over and over. Do you want to say something about that, just to try and, you know, at least get the information out now?
One rape is too many. The numbers don't matter. It is an imperative that anyone who experiences physical, sexual violence or is being exploited, it is an imperative that women, girls, boys, men that have been subject to gender-based violence have immediate access to life-saving.
All right. So the other day I was at a women-friendly space in Shamnapur, and one of the things that they love to do in the morning is gather together and sing songs that they used to sing back in Myanmar. And you could see them rocking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of women were crying.
Mm-hmm.
It was really emotional. But, I mean, there's something healing about it, clearly, mm-hmm. for them. What do you guys do to kind of alleviate the stress? Is there any music that you listen to or whatever?
I take pride in my work. I choose to be here, so I got to admit, we all work a lot. When I take my R&R, I like to meet up with my friends, talk to my family. It's important to remember that there's a world outside of this, yeah? As far as music, I'm an 80s kid. I grew up with Madonna, Michael Jackson. Who else is there? Prince.
Give us some Guns N' Roses, Karim.
Guns N' Roses. You know I like Guns N' Roses.
November Rain.
I'm a secret fan of karaoke, but I'm a terrible singer. And I don't know, maybe I like something to relax me at the time. But yeah, we're pretty focused on our work, and you make me realize that I don't really have a good answer for that. We just work and we get satisfaction out of it, but that's not sustainable. And we all need sustainable solutions, right?
It's true. We really do need to maintain balance for ourselves. And what you said also reminded me very much so that having that balance and having that space for community is also something that's so vital.
You're listening to the Lid Is On podcast from UN News. That was the UN Population Fund's Saba Zarif, an expert on gender-based violence, talking to communications specialist Veronica Pedroza, also of the UN Population Fund, or UNFPA, at the epicentre of the UN relief effort on behalf of the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. They were joined by Karim Elgindi of the World Food Programme, who's been in Cox's Bazaar for well over a year and is acting head of WFP's operation there. A big thanks to Veronica for hosting and all our guests for giving us some real insight into the Rohingya crisis. That's it from this edition of The Lid Is On. If you like what you've heard, there are more of our shows and interviews on the UN and its work across the world available at soundcloud.com/UN Radio. Thanks to Ketzer again for the inspiring music. This track's called Where the River Run. I'm Matt Wells at UN headquarters in New York. Thank you for listening.